Hello and welcome to ETY Podcast, Voices on the World of Work. I am your host, Bianca Luna Fabris, and in this episode, we will be focusing on the recent issue of our journal, Transfer, and particularly the roundtable debate on social Europe with three leading academics, Caroline Delaporte, Maurizio Ferrera, and Filippo Schipp. We will also be interviewing Hoishin Seo, that has just won the Transfer Young Scholar Award with a paper on labour market segmentation. Right, so let's start from the very first question. And if you don't mind, I would actually want to start with Maurizio. Do you think that the wave of austerity policies of the 2010s and their dire consequences have opened the door for a rebalancing process and a stronger social dimension of the EU?
Thank you. Yes, I am now, I must say, more optimistic than I was 10 years ago. Of course, I regret the fact that it has taken a dramatic pandemic to impress a social turn to integration. And we also should remember that in the first months of 2020, after the virus started to hit, the fracture, the old fracture between the northern frugal coalition and the southern solidarity coalition, which had been born during the euro crisis already, re-emerged with a vengeance. And nobody would have bet that in a few months, the member states would have agreed or would have been able to agree on such an ambitious plan as the Next Generation EU. But in the same periods, the European Social Agenda was also relaunched at the Porto Summit. So that's another reason for optimism. Of course, it was Germany, essentially what I call the conversion of Germany, that allowed for this turn, because Merkel put her force behind it. And now it remains to be seen whether the new German government will be willing not only to support the Solidarity Coalition, but also to maintain a leadership in it, a coalition which does not only consist of member states, but also of large segments of European civil societies.
Brilliant, thank you. Picking up on what you just said, Maurizio, I think maybe Philippe would like to jump in here. What about the role of politics?
I rather agree with Maurizio that we are in a different situation, and there is a potential. And clear example of that for me, if you compare the two crises, is the crisis 2008-13. What happened is mainly to deregulate the labor market, so the kind of pressure for Europe to deregulate. When you see what happened with the crisis at the beginning, is to take what was the best example in the previous crisis, so kind of learning, was Germany and some other countries, the short-term working time, so you keep the link to your employer, and then they generalize that at European level, and then you have sure to pay more or less, not so much, but to pay the new scheme. But what's interesting, you took the best and you ask all the member states to do that, and you have a European level. But the previous crisis can easily be explained by politics, because most of the government were on the right. The commission was on the right, 21 commissioners on the right, 6 on the left. And the parliament, there was the first time that the EPP could have the majority on the right, on the left. So basic political science is everyone is on the right. You don't have a progressive policy. But what about now? And we don't see a huge gain from the social democracy. On the contrary, the last 10 years was the 2010-20, the huge loss in social democracy in France, Italy, Germany, and quasi in all the countries in Europe. So you cannot explain purely by politics. And that's important, because I think the consensus to have something that's potential, you don't have the social biases. You don't have yet, perhaps, but you don't see a huge electorate supporting that. That support partly from the center-right, but for other reason, I think.
Thanks so much, Philippe. Now on to Caroline. I have a slightly different question here, if you don't mind. Good aspirations, but bad outcomes. In your article, you do mention that one of the most important directives of this legislature is the work-life balance directive, and this could be implemented unequally. Then why is this the case?
First, I'd like to say that, of course, I agree that there is a lot of potential in the pillar and many of the initiatives. But at the same time, the member states have different welfare state systems, different labor markets, and different levels of institutional capabilities and different levels of financial resources available for new social rights. And that is where that is my my starting point. My main point is that the Work-Life Balance Directive, nobody would have thought it would be possible to agree on such an ambitious directive. However, it has been agreed, and the main provisions are related to 10 days of paternity leave. Most countries have that. And then 2 months of earmarked leave per parent, paid at an adequate level. And this is where the differentiation comes in, because that means that those countries that have already a long parental leave but not earmarked, they can simply shift it, while those that have unpaid or paid at a very low level, they won't be able to have many new resources. Of course, we would hope that they would, but considering the financial constraint on welfare states, it's not necessarily going to be implemented in that way. That would be my main concern. But nevertheless, I'd like to exemplify the Work-Life Balance Directive with one case, the case of a Nordic country, of Denmark. So Denmark is, like the other Nordics, often suspicious of the European level of policymaking in social policy because of its labor market model, which is very flexible, and where there are no formal rules. And then this means that the working conditions, including parental pay, are constantly being renegotiated. But in advance of the directive, almost all the political parties in the establishment, from right to left, were against the directive, except for the social liberals and the alternative party, and the unions were against it, and the employers were against it, for the reason of subsidiarity. And then we see that after the directive has been adopted, what has happened is that the unions and the employers, they have changed position, and they now support the directive openly, and then they're going to do the earmarking, which will probably be at the level of unemployment benefit for those not covered by collective bargain, and it's likely to be picked up and topped up. My guess would be full wages. So in a way, this is a good story. It's a story about changing of position of the main actors, and actually ending up overcoming a regulatory tension, and this is likely to be the final outcome. But then there is a risk with countries like, for instance, France, where there is not a high level of compensation for parental leave. So there is parental leave, but it's not compensated at a high level. And so there, the most likely tension is going to be costs, most likely. And then the question is, what leverage there is for the European Union to impose an extra cost on welfare states. So that would be my main concern. And that's why I argue in the article that even if this directive and some others are potentially a breakthrough, at the same time, they also present some challenges, because implementation will be differentiated.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Caroline. Now back to Maurizio. There are some that may argue that the yardstick of political success for social Europe is the implementation of hard law, of binding legislation, such as, for example, the directive that we just discussed. But would you agree with this statement?
I would say that it is the main yardstick, but it is incomplete. And I'm arguing this because, you know, what matters for social citizenship and social rights, ultimately, are outputs and outcomes. And this is especially true for the realm of benefits in kind or in services. There, even if there is a subjective, codified entitlement and maybe even a right to justiciability, I mean, to access a court of justice, you still run the risk of insufficient, inadequate, or failing access and fruition, and especially access and fruition of high quality services. And let's remember that services are key for the paradigm of social investment. There, really, it is important that people take up the entitlements to the services that are key, you know, from child education and care to training opportunities and what have you. And there, if the state does not produce high quality services and does not put in place, you know, infrastructures that facilitate access and fruition, then you fail to actually achieve the target. Let us think, for example, of the dramatic problem of the NEETs, young people who are not in education nor in employment, where in many countries there are indeed provisions that entitle these people, these young people, to receive various benefits. But they don't take them up because they're not informed to begin with. And it's very difficult to intercept them. And once you have intercepted them, it is difficult to motivate them. So I think that we should extend our conception of social citizenship from, you know, a codified set of formal subjective rights accompanied with justiciability provisions to something more that reaches down to the point of the encounter between the target beneficiary and the benefit itself. And this encounter cannot be taken for granted because we are talking about vulnerable people. We are talking about people who are excluded from mainstream, you know, circuits of information and socialization. So efforts, dedicated efforts, must be made in order to facilitate and promote the take-up. In our youth social set process, we are elaborating a kind of novel conception of social citizenship, which is based on four types of resources. Normative resources, like the European principle of social rights. These are manifesto rights, you know, which set the direction but are not immediately justiciable. Then legal resources, which is what makes a right, an actual guarantee, a justiciable guarantee. But then infrastructural resources as well. And infrastructural resources can be provided by the state itself, but also with the help of non-profit, non-public associations and NGOs. And in fact, a lot of these organizations are already involved in this process, but they are not recognized and they're not systematically linked. And I think that the European Union can do a lot on this front. And the example of the youth guarantee in the southern member states teaches a lesson in this respect, because the youth guarantee has not really, you know, introduced a new legal right, subjective right, but it has introduced an obligation, you know, which is also part of rights, an obligation on the side of governments receiving EU funds to actually implement a program whose aim was exactly to intercept and facilitate the access into the training programs, and also, you know, then follow what happens after these people have attended the program. It is the first time in Italy that we have an archive with 70% of the alleged almost 2 million NEETs in the country. So we know who they are, we know where they live, and we have tried to actually involve them in training activities, and in many cases with success. And this was a result of an infrastructural investment which was prompted and orchestrated by the European Union.
Thanks so much, Maurizio. Philippe, do you actually agree with the statement? Do you think that the European pillar of social right is really fit to meet future challenges?
My answer will be yes and no. I think yes, because there is a change. There is some interesting proposal in, and there is also a kind of toolbox. What is important if in public policy at European level, that the social can be kept at the agenda. And to be kept at the agenda, you need to have some resource. And then I think the pillar is a resource. You don't have to think the pillar in detail. It's so complex when I have to teach that to my student. Nobody is understanding what I say because it's too complex. But if you simplify and you say it's for bureaucrats, for politicians, a resource to put some question on the table, and yet that you can keep that on the table is very important. Secondly, yes, because I think it mixes sometimes in an interesting way art and soft law. I have worked a lot on soft law with Caroline, and then I left the soft law. But if you look to the minimum wage directive, it's a really interesting case because you have the art law is the kind you have a directive, it's art law, and you will have a kind of threshold. But that's not the most interesting part of the directive. There is another part which is about collective bargaining and threshold to reach 70%. There you need to create actors, you need to create institutions, you need to have some social dynamic to create that. And mainly in Eastern Europe when the coverage is very, very low. So you cannot do by law. You cannot say you will be an actor by law. You need to have you need to create some dynamic. So for that, yes. But where I'm very critical, what is the key challenge for the future is the climate crisis. There is nothing in the social, no reflection from the Commission about the challenge of the big transition that we will have because of the challenges of the climate change. They just ignore that it's kind of program of the past. They don't put, I would put a good question, what is, if climate change necessitate degrowth, what is the impact on pension? I think it's start to think about that. I don't say that we have an answer about that, but let's think about that. Let's put that in the table, and we have plenty of question when you will have restructuring of huge sector and not the coal. The coal is not interesting. There is just 0.1% of the working people in Poland are in the coal sector. But the automotive industry, 10 million people will have, what will be the mobility for the future? And that will impact a lot of sector. What will be the battery? Is that a good job to work in a battery factory? Apparently not. Not in China. Not from the news we have from Hungary. So there is a lot of very important questions that are not addressed in the pillar, and not even more than not addressed, ignore, I would say.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Philippe. Now on to Caroline for our very last question. What about the internal imbalances within the EU? We know that member states in general terms support the underlying principles of the pillar, but do they actually want it at the same level? In other terms, and I assume that the answer here is no, but do member states actually want the same level of involvement of the European Union in social and labour market policies?
I think it's a good question. And indeed, there is a big difference among member states, but also unions and employers, about the extent to which they support the EU involvement. And I showcased with the Work-Life Balance Directive, the Nordics, they are very suspicious of the EU involvement. And now we can see the Work-Life Balance Directive. This has been solved in a sense, and they've taken ownership. It's not undermining the model. But there's a lot more tension around the Minimum Work Directive, where there's a fear that the features of the model will be undermined. So let's see how that that works out. At the same time, there are other countries that would want more EU involvement, but like linking to what Maurizio was saying, they may not have the infrastructure or institutional capabilities. So there that there are other challenges. And in countries where even where unions have very they don't have a low union density and not many members there, they see the pillar as a way to re-legitimize and strengthen their power within their sectors or countries. Yet if they don't have the means to influence the policy process, then, of course, that's a challenge. And then finally, there are countries, and then employers, of course, they're always a bit suspicious. They think it costs too much and there's more regulation. We don't want that. And then there are the Eastern European countries, where some have very weak resources, as Bulgaria, Romania, and some also are opposed for other reasons, such as, for instance, Poland, where the government is very conservative, and also there are the current rule of law challenges. But here the issue with the Work-Life Balance Directive is more about gender roles, and there's suspicion on that account. But also because Poland is not keen on having the EU involved in its social policies. But it's a bit of an irony because Poland has, in fact, if we turn to the minimum wage, it has increased the minimum wage over the past few years because Poland wanted to be an attractive workplace, so to avoid workers leaving Poland. It's kind of like the problem with the Nordics. It's not about the policy. It's more about who the messenger is.
Now, before we move on to the second half of our episode, I just want to reiterate that you can find the three articles that have been at the very heart and center of the discussion that we just had in the show notes. And you also might want to check out the link to the Project EU Social Sit, a project on the current state of social rights in Europe, on which both Caroline and Maurizio have been working on. So now on to the second half of our episode with Hoshin Seo. She is Research Associate at the Centre for Sociological Research at KU Leuven here in Belgium. And she has very recently won the Young Transfer Award with an article on labour market segmentation. Hello and welcome, Hoshin. So in just a few words, can you perhaps summarise your article?
First of all, thank you for having me. The paper is on how the labor market is divided in Europe, accounting for various labor market precariousness, such as type of employment contract, income level, subjective insecurity, and prospects for advancement. So the paper finds that when we account for these various dimensions, the European labor market is not as clear-cut as having those who are all secure and those who are all precarious. Rather, there are different types of precarious jobs between the two. So there can be people who have secure employment contract but low income and lack of prospects, but there are also people who have secure employment, decent income, but they feel insecure about their employment. And I think what was also interesting is that the proportion of these different precarious workers actually varied across countries. which opens up new questions actually after this research on why we see such cross-national variations.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And then why did you send in your paper for the Young Transfer Award?
To answer your question, I applied for this award because I mean, this is a very prestigious journal, first of all. So there is, you know, obviously everyone would want to apply. That's not a question for me. But I actually was quite certain that I'll be able to receive very helpful feedbacks because I was in the middle of my PhD as well. And I thought that will help me to with the development of my PhD thesis, which I did at the end. The feedbacks I received at the end were more helpful than I expected. It was really great.
Thank you, Hoisin, and also thank you to the guests that have been with us for the very first half, Caroline, Maurizio, and Philippe, and for all of you guys that are still listening. You can find the articles that we've just discussed in the show notes. Thank you.